From the New York Times, this is The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. Today, the immigration ban is litigated live in our highest courts. It's a rare opportunity to listen in as our judicial system answers a fundamental question about what kind of a country we're going to be. The Times examines a claim that the media, us included, repeatedly ignored or underreported attacks by Islamic terrorists, and why the 60-year-old words of the novelist James Baldwin, captured in a new film, are so resonant right now. It's Wednesday, February 8th.
Good afternoon. The case on our emergency motion docket today is State of Washington et al. Versus Donald J. Trump et al., case number 17-35.
It's 3 p.m. in San Francisco, and the U.S. Court of Appeals is now in session. Somehow, it's been just a week and a half since President Trump issued his unannounced immigration ban that left thousands of people stranded or detained, provoked protests at airports across the country, and resulted in a slew of lawsuits filed by states against the federal government. Those lawsuits ricocheted across the judicial system and landed with extraordinary speed here on Tuesday afternoon in the United States Court of Appeals.
Mr. Flengey, are you on the call?
I'm here. Thank you.
Great.
With such speed that attorneys for the prosecution and the defense and one of the three judges on the panel are joining by phone.
Appearing from Washington, Mr. Purcell, are you here with us on the call?
I am, yes.
So are tens of thousands of Americans who, thanks to San Francisco's open court system, are listening in on the hearing via live stream. Jesse Wegman and I are among them. Jesse writes about the courts for the Times editorial board.
This is going to be apparently a conference call. Everybody's phoning it in.
That's rare.
It's unusual in this day and age when we have airplanes and cars.
So both legal teams, for Trump and for the states, are being given 30 minutes to present their side, starting with the attorneys representing the president.
I'm August Flengey with the Justice Department here on behalf of the United States. The executive order at issue puts a temporary pause on entry for individuals from seven countries that Congress and the last president determined in a similar context pose special risks in terms of terrorist infiltration into our country.
The judges sound skeptical.
Yes, but you appealed to us before you continued in the district court to develop the record.
So one of the judges is asking a lawyer for the White House whether the government has any real evidence connecting these seven countries that are named under the ban to terrorism.
Yeah, and it's funny. His answer is basically no.
Which is a pretty remarkable concession to have to make.
Well, I was just about to at least mention a few examples. There have been a number of people from Somalia connected to al-Shabaab who have been convicted in the United States.
Is that in the record? Can you point us to where in the record you're referring?
It's unusual not to put evidence in the record that is central to making your case. So I think he's essentially conceding the point that they have no evidence that anyone from any of these seven identified countries has been involved in a terror attack in this country.
Is that
recently
a big deal legally at this moment in the case?
I think it remains to be seen. I think it could be a very big deal if the court decides that the government needs to prove that there is some rational connection between the singling out of these countries and the risk of terror in America, which is ostensibly the whole point of this executive order.
But I'm not sure I'm convincing the court, so I want to make one really key point with regard to the injunction, and that is that it is overbroad and should be immediately stayed to the extent it is overbroad, even if the court thinks some applications of the order are problematic.
So now the lawyer for Trump seems to be conceding that he might not win this whole thing. I mean, he seems to be actively admitting, I know I might lose part of this case. First of all, why would he do that? And then what victory might remain for him?
He, you know, they wrote this in their brief, too, to the court. it's clear that they don't feel entirely confident that they're going to win this outright. And one strategy that lawyers take is to say, well, if I can't have 100%, give me 50%. What he's saying here is maybe you're not going to give us the whole case, but at least lift the ban on the order as it pertains to people who have never been in this country before. You know, maybe they're willing to let go of the idea of people who kind of come back and forth or who have connections to America. Yeah, people who are married to U.S. citizens, that kind of thing. But for people who have never been in America, he's saying you have to let the order stand.
So give me half a victory, please, judges, is kind of what this moment is.
It sounds like it, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Purcell?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court.
So the 30 minutes are now up for the lawyers for President Trump, and now the case is swiveling over to the lawyer for Washington State.
We detailed a number of irreparable harms, Your Honor. We had students and faculty at our state universities who were stranded overseas. We had families that were separated.
The state of Washington lawyer is arguing now that the residents of his state have been, like, truly and demonstrably harmed by this immigration ban. Is he making a compelling case to the judges?
You know, it's a familiar argument. He's basically saying this is harming our residents who work in state universities, at state hospitals. I think it's their best shot right now, and we'll see how it plays out.
Well, let me ask about the, I'll call just religious discrimination claim. I'm not entirely persuaded by the argument, if only because the seven countries encompass only a relatively small percentage of Muslims. I mean, do you have any information as to what percentage or what proportion of the adherents to Islam worldwide are citizens or residents of those countries?
And we've broken out, like, real math here.
My quick penciling suggests it's something less than 15%.
I have not done that math, Your Honor, but
it's interesting. This is Judge Clifton who's asking this question. He's the George W. Bush appointee, and he's clearly been the most skeptical of the three judges toward the state's lawyer. And his point is it's a powerful one, which is if there are only 15% of the entire Muslim population of the world who are impacted by this particular order, how can you say that this is religiously discriminatory?
Your Honor, the case law from this court and the Supreme Court is very clear that to prove religious discrimination, we do not need to prove that this order harms only Muslims or that it harms every Muslim. We just need to prove that it was motivated in part by a desire to harm Muslims.
So the state's lawyer is giving the answer which he should give, which is it doesn't matter if it's one Muslim or 1 billion Muslims. The point is the intent of the government in issuing this executive order. If the intent is to discriminate on the basis of religion, that is a constitutional violation. It doesn't matter how many Muslims are affected.
How do you infer that desire if, in fact, the vast majority of Muslims are unaffected?
Well, Your Honor, in part, you can infer it from intent evidence. I mean, there are statements that we've quoted in our complaint that are rather shocking evidence.
So this is really interesting. That phrase about rather shocking evidence.
I mean, the public statements from the president and his top advisors reflecting that intent.
A clear reference to the words of Donald Trump, particularly as a candidate, who called for a ban against Muslims. And it sounds like what he's saying is, I have all the evidence I need, and it's just a loop of campaign rallies and speeches and interviews that show that this man was motivated by discrimination.
You know, it's funny. This comes back to the bad faith issue, which the judges were pressing the Trump lawyers on. And that is, the administration is insisting on an extreme level of deference here. They're basically saying, stay out of it, courts. This is our business. You don't have the power to review this, or you have minimal power to review this. And what the courts are saying and what the state's attorney is saying is, you know what? Stand back a little and look at the bigger picture here. You have done nothing but trumpet a Muslim ban for the last year and a half. When there's that kind of evidence of bad faith, the courts are much less likely to give the executive that deference.
Deny that, in fact, the statements attributed to then-candidate Trump and to his political advisors, and most recently, Mr. Giuliani. Do you deny that those statements were made?
Judge Clifton, I know. I would note that Judge Robart himself said that he wasn't going to look at campaign statements.
The judge just asked the lawyer for Donald Trump really, really pointedly, did President Trump not say those things that we all know he said?
This is one of the most painful...
Lose.
This is one of the most painful moments for an advocate is... You know, the court is putting it right in your face. The worst pieces of your case are shoved right in your face, and you don't want to admit it, but he really has nowhere to go. Yes, of course Donald Trump said these things, and of course Rudy Giuliani said these things, and there's really nothing he can do other than just, hope it ends soon.
It is potential evidence. It is a basis for an argument, so I just want to make sure I know what's on the table.
So put at its most simply, what... After listening to the 30 or so minutes of the government's case, the president's case, was his main argument?
Their basic point was back off, courts. This is the president's job and not for you to review.
And put just as simply, what were the state's arguments?
State was saying, we all know why you did this. Even if you don't admit it, it's a constitutional violation and it should be struck down.
So if you could hazard a guess... How long before we have a ruling? I mean, in many ways, the whole nation is kind of on edge and wants to figure out whether this ban goes back into effect or it stays off the books.
Well, I'll say this. It sounded like they are really working to get this out before the end of the week. So I would imagine we'll have a ruling in the next couple of days. I'd say, you know, it sounded like a 2-1 in favor of the states. But that still just sends this right back down to the lower court, which will continue to hear.
So one kind of one layer down.
That's right. And then we'll issue a longer-term ruling in the case, which would put a longer hold on the president's executive order. And then this would come right back up to the federal appeals court and then obviously to the Supreme Court. All of that is going to take weeks, if not months. So we probably won't see a resolution to this until spring or summer.
A final note on the immigration ban. Angered by the resistance to his executive order, President Trump is now claiming that the news media is systematically underreporting terrorist attacks around the world, playing down the threat. To make his point, he published a list of 78 attacks between 2014 and 2016. Our colleagues went back and examined what kind of coverage they received at the time. Dozens of those attacks, they found, were covered heavily, including in the New York Times. What may be most notable were the attacks the president left off the list, attacks targeting Muslims, who make up the majority of the victims of Islamic terrorism around the world.
Mr. Bolden,
welcome back to The Daily.
I'm sure you still meet the remark that, what are the Negroes, why aren't they optimistic? They say, but it's getting so much better. There are Negro mayors. There's Negroes in all of sports. There are Negroes in politics. They're even accorded the ultimate accolade of being in television commercials now. And, I'm glad you're smiling. Is it at once getting much better and still hopeless?
Well, I don't think there's much hope for it, you know, to tell you the truth. You know, as long as people are using this peculiar language. It's not a question of what happens to the Negro here, or to the black man here. That's a very vivid question for me, you know. But the real question is what's going to happen to this country. I have to repeat that.
I've been low, I've been high.
The writer James Baldwin was in many ways the conscience of the civil rights movement.
The future of the Negro in this country is precisely as bright or as dark as the future of the country.
Although Baldwin died in 1987, a new documentary, I Am Not Your Negro, about an unfinished book he was working on, reveals just how loudly his writing would echo into the 21st century. I want to ask you what you brought here. It's sitting on the table between us.
Yeah.
It's
the Library of America's collected essays of James Baldwin.
Wesley Morris is the chief culture critic at the Times.
I do keep a copy. I have two copies. I have one that sits on my desk and I have one from home. The one from my desk is missing. I don't know who in this building took it.
It wasn't me. It feels to me it always takes a piece of art or a piece of filmmaking to remind us how much a figure from the past speaks powerfully to our present.
Mm-hmm.
Why does it feel like James Baldwin speaks so urgently to this moment?
Well, there's so many answers to that question. I think the primary answer is that the specific things he is writing about, black bodies, black death at the hands of white people, denial that slavery still means something.
What this does to the subjugated is to destroy his sense of reality. In the case of an American Negro, born in that glittering republic, and in the moment you are born, since you don't know any better, every stick and stone and every face is white, and since you have not yet seen a mirror, you suppose that you are too. It comes as a great shock around the age of 5 or 6 or 7 to discover the flag to which you have pledged allegiance has not pledged allegiance to you.
And Baldwin was aware of this in the 1950s, was that there's a way of being an American that focuses only on the future or on the present and doesn't allow for the ways in which the past are always still with us.
It comes as a great shock to discover that Gary Cooper killing off the Indians when you were rooting for Gary Cooper, that the Indians were you. It comes as a great shock to discover that the country which is your birthplace and to which you owe your life and your identity has not in its whole system of reality evolved any place for you.
He spent a lot of time trying to make an emotional, intellectual argument for why it's necessary to keep reminding white people of the psychic toll of racism.
The disaffection, the demoralization begins there and accelerates throughout a whole lifetime. So that presently you realize you're 30 and are having a terrible time managing to trust your countrymen. Is by that time you've begun to see it happening in your daughter or your son or your niece or your nephew. You are 30 by now, and nothing you have done has helped to escape the trap. But what is worse than that is that nothing you have done, and as far as you can tell, nothing you can do, will save your son or your daughter from meeting the same disaster and possibly coming to the same end.
I want to talk about the experience of watching James Baldwin.
Yeah.
I can't stop looking at him. And I wonder if you feel the same way, because there's something about his movements and his body that's really...
And his face.
And it's really electric. And
right.
I wonder how you would describe it.
Well, you know, I mean, he was a creature of the theater. Like, he knew how to perform himself.
I can't be a pessimist because I'm alive.
He knew what it meant to hold a pause.
To be a pessimist means that you have agreed that human life is an academic matter.
And James Baldwin, because TV was so new, there had been no established way of being on TV. He was establishing it.
Which one of James Baldwin's insights, Wesley, do you feel is still most urgent and relevant right now?
It might be the idea that black people are basically a white invention.
It is a terrible thing for an entire people to surrender to the notion that 1/9 of its population is beneath them.
You know, a black self exists in opposition to, in degraded opposition to white selves.
And until that moment, until the moment comes when we, the American people, are able to accept the fact that I have to accept, for example, that my ancestors are both white and black, that on that continent we are trying to forge a new identity for which we need each other, and that I am not a ward of America. I am not an object of missionary charity. I am one of the people who built the country. Until this moment, there is scarcely any hope for the American dream, because the people who are denied participation in it, by their very presence, we'll wreck it. And if that happens, it's a very grave moment for the West.
And I think that's the most powerful thing about James Baldwin. And that's an infuriating thing to have to keep arguing for centuries.
Wesley, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
I Am Not Your Negro is now in theaters across the country, and Wesley Morris, in addition to his brilliant writing, co-hosts a Times podcast called Still Processing. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.